Hello, you're listening to the Accents podcast on WUKY. This episode is brought to you by Kentucky Humanities and the Kentucky Book Festival. I am the host, Katerina Stoikova. Today, my guest is writer Angela Kurel. Hi, Angela. Welcome to Accents.
Hi, Katerina. So good to be here.
You are the author of Restored in Tuscany, a true story of facing loss, finding beauty and living forward in hope, which, in short, is a book about following your dreams.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what it is. Taking an adventure, doing something a little outside the box.
And a little outside of home, right?
A little outside of home, that's right.
It's a memoir, right?
Yes.
Did it feel risky to publish a memoir, to write about yourself and people you know?
Yes, because before this, I've written three fiction books. And I think as a writer, it's kind of nice to hide behind your characters in fiction. And you can write characters that are like you, that are different from you, that say things you might say, that would say things that you would never say. And when you're writing a memoir, it's your story. And so there is definitely a sense of vulnerability there that I don't think as a fiction writer I quite have, because when you do write fiction, people will say, oh, this is you, is that you, or is that your husband, or is that your mother? And it's easy to say, even if there were little pieces of that, it's easy to say, no, this is a unique character that I've created, maybe inspired by, but it's definitely different. And so, yes, a little bit scary and vulnerable, but also at the same time, I think it's immensely pleasurable when people say that they resonate with things that I've thought or things I've gone through or even the idea of this experience. And so that's actually even a deeper level than some of the comments you might get from fiction writing. So it's a new experience. I'm really enjoying it so far.
It's a personal experience for you, but also more personal experience for the readers.
Yes, exactly.
I would love for you to talk about the book and the story.
Yes. Well, the book really started with my fiction work. So I was writing the second book, second fiction book. It's a trilogy, set mostly in Kentucky, but also partly in Italy. And so as I was going to work on the second book, I wanted to find a place in Italy. And I really, in my mind, felt like Tuscany was the place, because I wanted to sort of parallel a character who had family connections to a family in Kentucky and who actually lived in a similar landscape. And Tuscany is very similar to Kentucky in the agricultural feel of the place, the connection to the land, the food, faith, family, food, farm is what I like to say. I feel like there are many similarities. And so that was where I was drawn to set this story. But it also came along at a time in my life when I was pretty exhausted with starting a bunch of businesses, and I've learned since that I'm a creator, but I'm not a manager. And so I was trying to manage these creations, and that was just sucking the life out of me in many ways, and not necessarily was I operating out of my giftedness or even just being stretched in all kinds of ways, which is good at some level, but I think at some point that can also be exhausting. And we were also grieving our son-in-law who had passed away the year before. And so as I went into this, trying to find a place to set this book, I was just needing some soul refreshment myself, to be honest. And so under the guise of trying to find this place to set the book, I sort of sold it to my husband as, oh, I really need this for writing. But really, the truth was I need it for myself. And so we went to this little village that we found. We found an apartment online, and like 6 weeks before we ended up traveling and had no idea where we were going to, what it was going to be like, And just for 2 weeks, unpacked our suitcases. I wrote, we explored the countryside and truly fell in love with this village during that process. The people, the place, the rhythm of life there. And every year found ourselves returning to this village. And so after a few years, we started thinking about what if we bought something just small that we could move right into and on the, at the
end. Something manageable.
Yes, something manageable, really easy, just not have to worry, not have to put too much into it. And so at the end of a trip, we thought we found just such a thing. And it spoke to us in a way that I can't even, hardly even explain it. It just literally felt like it was calling our names. And we went home, made an offer, ended up buying it. And then, of course, as the story goes, we got there a few months later, thought we were just going to slap some paint on the walls and move right in, and found we had a total restoration on our hands. And not at all what we wanted. But so that's kind of really how the book, I knew this is going to be interesting. As a writer, every time you go through an experience, an adventure, an experience or whatever, you think, okay, there's a story in here. I don't know what kind of story, but there's a story in here. So I knew as we went through that process, I wanted to take lots of notes and make sure to write something at some point. I did not quite know it would turn into what it eventually turned into.
What does restoration look like? What kind of form does it take?
Well, house or soul?
Yes.
Yes. Well, the things I've learned in restoration, and I honestly think it transfers both to whether it be a house or a life, is that in restoration, you have to do demolition first. And that's something I've always known about restoration projects because we've done so many in Stanford. But it really didn't hit me until we did the one in Italy that I walked in one day and there was just all this rubble on the ground, you know, inside the house and or on the dirt floor. It was dusty, it was messy, and you know, you could just almost choke walking through all the dust. And I realized that everything had to come off the walls, had to be chipped away, had to be taken down to just the bare studs in order to be built back up. And I think that truly is a picture of even a life restoration. Sometimes you realize that you've just been, your life has been going along based on things that you've believed from childhood or things that you've told yourself. You know, I have to work hard, I have to prove myself, or I have to do this, or I have to do that. You kind of place your identity, and there's just something beautiful about sort of tearing that down and rebuilding. And that honestly is, I think, what restoration means to me.
I think you said it great. Before you can have restoration, you need to have demolition. Travel is, to continue with that metaphor, demolition is, as you said, messy. Sometimes we get things demolished for us. We don't just wield the hammer ourselves.
That's right. I think it can be a combination, honestly. And I think sometimes things happen that obviously we would have never asked for, whether it be a loss, a death, a divorce, whatever it is, or an illness. But then those are also opportunities, I think, for building back up. And it's not always an easy thing to go through, but it is messy. I remember talking to somebody one time, and I appreciated his honesty. He was probably, I think he was like maybe 70 or 75 years old, and we were talking about things in life that can impact us and that maybe need to be sort of ferreted out, uncovered, and dug into a bit. And he said, yeah, he said, I know there's stuff there, but I don't want to go there. I'm just not going to do it, and I'm not going to do the work. And I mean, I think there's something to at least recognizing that you don't want to go there. But for me, I felt like I wanted to go there and I needed to go there. And I'm glad I did.
How does one guard time for restoring, and why is busyness so seductive?
That is a great question. I think it's different for different people, of course, but for me, I think staying busy, I saw that being modeled by my parents, and part of what I discovered as I dug in and did some of the work and just, you know, why I had some of the habits I had was just realizing that you do tend to model what your parents do. And so I saw them working. You know, my dad had, he had two jobs, my mother had three jobs. And
how many do you have?
Right now?
Yeah.
Probably five. I don't know. I'm sure it's something like that. But the good thing is, after going through this process, I am much better now at figuring out when I need to step in and when I don't. We have a great team of folks with all of our businesses downtown that do a wonderful job. And so they really only lean on me for a few things. And I'm trying very hard as founder not to step into things when I don't need to. So that's been helpful to learn. And I have much more time now than I used to, which tells me that I'm on the right path, because otherwise I used to fill my time up constantly. I just felt like I need to be busy all the time, that if I wasn't busy, I wasn't being productive. And if I wasn't productive, you know, I was just, what are you saying to yourself? So you're, you know, are you, why do we have to kind of keep doing this? And I think for me, it was just that whole thing of, you know, if I'm busy, you know, then you get approval from my parents. You know, I think a lot of that went back to my parents of, I knew that that's what they valued. And so as long as I was just kind of working hard and filling my time up with all the right things as I saw them, then that was worthy in some way. And rather than, you know, where does your identity really come from, or where it really should come from? And so I think it's just the nature of what we do, and sometimes it's distraction. If we're busy, then we can just distract ourselves from maybe some harder questions or things that we need to think about. And so I think that's a natural thing that we do as humans.
I'm going to ask you about your relationship with work. I explore that. I've spoken about it on this podcast. I'm writing a poetry book, and the title is I Want to Run Away and Marry a Job and Other Poems. And I got a few jobs, like a list of them.
Yes.
And that is so interesting for me. You started working when you were 7 years old.
Yes.
Yeah. What is your relationship with work?
Well, I love work. I really do. I love to work. I love to work in the areas in particular that I feel gifted in working, creative types of work. I love to work with my hands. I love to get my hands in dirt. I love to grow things. I love to can food, preserve food. And so those kinds of things are absolute joys for me. And so I think my relationship with work is that it is something that I love, and I probably have been married to it many times. I think it's also can be too much, and it's too much when it's affecting your health in some way. It's too much when it's affecting your relationships, with your spiritual life, I think, your emotional life. I think that's when it's too much and it gets out of balance. And I also feel like I feel that more when I am doing the kind of work that is life draining rather than life giving. And my husband always says that, you know, if you're working at something that you love, you really never work a day in your life. And I do think there's a lot of truth in that, because I can tell the days that are hard for me are the days I'm doing things that really are, you know, outside of what I feel like I'm gifted at doing.
But isn't it true that as long as we're alive, we'll be doing things. I mean, even if you sit there on a chair and look at the view from your house in Tuscany, that's doing something.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And even then, as a writer, I feel like those moments are valuable, because when I sit there and I look at a view, I'm taking in the description, I'm taking in the colors, I'm taking in the way I feel, I'm taking in what I hear, I'm taking in any conversations that might be floating around. And as a writer, those moments are valuable, because you really are soaking in a sense of place. And that sense of place is what I really want to communicate to the reader. I want to bring a reader into exactly that moment. And so the reader might not be able to travel to Tuscany, may not want to travel to Tuscany. But if I can bring the reader into that space for a moment, then they will feel like they've been there. I hope.
Yeah, I was going to read one passage, but I'll read another one now. And it is about food.
There's a lot of food in the book.
Yes, and there are wonderful photos. After unpacking, we visit the local market and fill our tiny kitchen with cheeses, salamis, fruit, tomatoes, garlic, onions, and bread. The delicate musky scent of peach is too much. I cut one and share half with Jess. Ripe peaches will forever remind me of our honeymoon, when we drove up and down Italy in a mad dash to see all the sights, gathering fresh peaches, cheese, and bread for our roadside picnics on the way from one city to another. I savor the sweet and tart flavor in my mouth and imagine it holds the promise of a second honeymoon.
Oh.
Wow.
You read that so beautifully. Far better than I could have.
My pleasure. But let me tell you what was the first place in the book that I was really hooked. And it was, I cannot read the whole thing, but I'm just going to read first sentences from this paragraphs. Now that I'm thinking about it, why didn't I listen to my gut and tell her the timing is not good because I'm knee-deep in... Right, and then why didn't I consider saying no because... Why didn't I pause and think about... Why didn't I consider how little I have seen my friends recently?
Mm-hmm.
And finally, why didn't I think about how little downtime I spent with my husband? Right?
Yes. And how little time I spend with me.
With me, yeah.
Yes. So, yes.
So that is so relatable.
Yes. I think so many of us feel that way. And there's just a deep frustration. Or at least I was writing that from the memory of a deep frustration of being so overscheduled that not only am I not even spending time with the people that are really important to me, but I'm not even having time for myself. And there is something about, if you're not refreshing yourself, you really can't refresh other people.
Most of us, I mean, we need to be alone in order to create. I don't know why and how, except in the group arts, which... You know, like movies, people get together and create something together. And that's wonderful. But in this book, Angela took her manuscript, you know, her book in progress, and Jace took his
art, painting.
Yes, his painting, you know, somehow incidentally jumped into his suitcase, right? And then they had to go away. In order to do art. So my question is, why do we need to go away to some distant place in order to be creative? Can we live our regular lives in such a way that they allow for creativity.
Yes, absolutely. That is, I think, what most creatives wrestle with. I have struggled in the past with, especially in years past, of is my art, is it really worthy enough for me to set aside time that is sacred at some level? Is it okay to do that? Is it okay? And when I
and
say...
whose permission?
Exactly.
Right?
My own permission. There's really no one else. But is it okay? Am I giving myself permission to set aside that time to be creative? And I think when we go away, we somehow think, okay, we're on holiday, we're on vacation, so then this is okay for me to do my art here because I'm away, I don't have all these other things pulling at me, so it's okay for me to do this here. But the reality is, it's not only okay for you to incorporate it into your daily life, but I would even argue it's somewhat necessary for you to incorporate it into your daily life, or at least during the week, if it's not a daily thing, because I do think it gives you perspective. It gives you a certain amount of energy as a creative. It gives you, I think it's a soul refreshment, honestly. I really think there's this something, it just feeds sort of this creative spirit inside that comes out in all sorts of ways. And even my husband, who's a businessman, he feels like he does better in his work if he has that creative time. And so if he does a painting on a Sunday afternoon, I feel like he almost has a little bit more of a spring in his step Monday morning. And so I think there is something valuable about that for all of us, no matter what our profession is, to have some creative outlet in some way. I think most of us are creative beings, whether we realize it or not, different levels probably. But
well, I think that business is a super creative field.
Very creative, actually. Very creative. And I mean, and he would agree with that. I mean, he would absolutely agree that creativity is part of what he uses every day. And so I think we do have to get past that. And so many writers, as I talk to writers, especially, you know, earlier on the journey, I think as you get down the road, you realize the value of it even more. But early or younger writers, and I don't mean young age-wise, I mean younger in the process, often say to me, well, I just don't have the time to write. And there are seasons. I do believe we all are in certain seasons. But some will say, I just really don't have the time to write. And I always kind of say, well, do you have the time not to write?
Can you afford not to write too?
Can you write?
I'm going to quote you again here.
Okay.
I fought doubts, rejection, and a strong desire to chuck my writing into the nearby lake. I've experienced a nearly magnetic pull toward other responsibilities, especially those that have an easy start and finish. After all, a book can drone on with no end in sight, but a dishwasher has start and end cycles. Through it all, the decision that I cannot live without writing guides my perseverance and keeps me opening the laptop and opening my mind.
Yes. I had to come to that because...
it's life and death. That, and people don't understand that.
Yes, it really is. It is. I think that I'll never forget the day that I realized that I couldn't not write. And I know that's a double negative, and I'm sorry, all you English teachers out there, but I don't really know how to express it other than that. But I was in my bathroom. I was coming out of the shower, and I was just, again, wrestling with this whole thing of, golly, you know, am I just wasting my time getting up every morning, sitting down and churning out whatever several pages? Is this going to come to anything? or do I just need to give it up and do something else? And then it just hit me almost like lightning. I can't even, it was such a strong, I just feel like it just, I don't know, I just think it came from God, but I just had this strong word that came to me that said, you cannot not write. You cannot live without writing. And once I realized that I accepted that, I thought, that's true. That's who I am. That's who I made. That's what I'm made to do. Once I accepted that, then there was just no issue. It's like, now I still struggle with carving out time sometimes with the new project, but there's no question of, am I going to do it?
Tell us a few of your non-negotiables as a person and as a writer.
That's good. That is a really good one. I haven't thought about that, so I'm just going to go off the cuff here. But this is you've actually asked me a question that I want to give some more thought to, because I feel like that's a super important question, and those answers are important. But I'm going to say, for one of my non-negotiables is that I am going to write, no matter what. I'm going to write something, and I don't necessarily write every day, but I'm thinking about writing every day, in the sense that whether it's how I register things in my senses, I hear somebody tell a story that for some reason is really funny, or there's a turn of phrase. Of course, in Kentucky, we have so many interesting phrases and sayings that I just want to log into my mind. I use my voice memo on my phone all the time. I love that, because I'll just say something into that and log that for later. So I'm always thinking about it. So that really is a non-negotiable for me. That's just understood. I'm always going to write, and that is my life. The other non-negotiable for me is I am committed to encouraging other writers. I feel like that's something that is, I received encouragement from people along the way that I don't know that I would be here today if they hadn't encouraged me. My husband was number one, huge encourager, but I always want to encourage other writers. I think it is such a lonely and solitary profession in some ways that I love encouraging other people. So I really try to do that if at all possible. I mean, it's a non-negotiable. It's just how many times, how many ways can I do it? I'm always trying to do that and make that a priority. So that's a big one. And then actually, I think it even comes to just arts in general. I do love encouraging anybody with a creative bent, because it's easy to let that get lost in just the day-to-day stuff. The other non-negotiable for me, I've decided that as long as I have a functioning brain, I'm going to work in writing. That I don't ever envision a time when I would retire. I mean, I think obviously if there's a point where it's no longer possible, that's one thing. But for me, as long as I can write, I'm going to write. So I don't ever want to stop until I've drawn my last breath or my brain just doesn't function anymore. So that's another non-negotiable for me. So I'm going to think about that. That's a great question, Katarina. You've given me something to ponder.
I'm so glad. I'm going to have to answer that question for myself also.
Yes, I would like to hear your answer.
This is a beautifully produced book. Please describe the cover.
Well, the cover is a picture of my front door in Tuscany. So it's the door that we restored, part of the restoration process. And for me, it's symbolic because a door has so many possibilities. And when you see a door, and the door on the cover is partially open, which I feel like is very symbolic, because it's an invitation. When you see a door that's slightly open, I feel like that's an invitation to walk through. And so it's an invitation for the reader to go on the journey with me, but it also represents to me the fact that I did walk through that door and worked on the restoration, and then now it's available for other people to walk through the door. So I love that that door is on the cover of it.
You know, for me, that door also was a symbol of the negotiation between private and public, between guarding time versus giving time, and that worked for me in so many levels.
Oh, so many levels. That's good. Yes, I like that. Yes, and then the medieval door, as we kind of get into the book, there's some discussion of those medieval fortress-like ramparts and things that are important to the whole process as I go through that. So yeah, a lot of symbolism there, really.
And talk about the photographs that are included.
Yes, the photographs are, there are several photographs inside the book, and they're all sort of in this black and white, maybe kind of sepia tone. And I think the publisher really wanted to give the reader a feel of it being kind of going back in time a bit. And so they're actual photographs of the renovation process and of some particular things that happened along the way. There's also one with my mother in there, because my mother has a pretty big role in this book. And there's then you get to see some pictures of the finished product as well. But I don't know how other people are, but when I read someone's story, there's a point, I'll read to a certain point in the story, and then I just have to stop because I just have to see what they look like. I just want to know, what do they look like? What does this place look like? What is she talking about here? And so I was really excited that the publisher did want to include some pictures just so that the reader feels even more drawn into the story.
This is the next thing that really fascinated me and surprised me for a personal reason, because I also do this. So here it is. It's finished, I say to myself, reflecting on the last 2 weeks and the miracle that I actually wrote half a book here. There will be many more revisions to come, but a first draft is something to celebrate. You're done? Jess stands in the doorway, a plump peach in his hand. I reach for my phone and hit play, and Handel's Hallelujah chorus erupts. We dance on the patio, taking bites of the peach and letting the juice run down our chins. That is part of your process, right?
Yes.
Get it.
Yes. Every time I finish a book, I play Handel's Messiah. Because I truly do, not the whole thing, I play the Hallelujah chorus, but I just feel like it's a celebration.
I play a Rocky's theme song.
Oh, me too. That's a good one.
Yeah.
That's a really good one, actually. I might have to switch over. That's a great one.
I do it on every revision, though. Every time I feel like I have completed the revision, I play it, and my husband knows that.
That it's a symbol.
Yeah, that I've made step forward.
Okay, yeah. She's done.
Yeah. Okay, she's going to be in good mood. That's great.
Exactly. I know, my poor husband, sometimes he's been so great and so encouraging. But, you know, those that are married to or partnering with a creative, it can be a challenge because there are the moods that kind of tend to go along with that. If it's not going well, you're kind of feeling that. If it's going really well, you're feeling that too. So,
well, that's a non-negotiable, a partner who is supportive.
Yeah, actually, that's a really great one, isn't it? Because it's a huge thing. It's a huge thing because it really, you just don't do it alone. I mean, you do it alone, but yet, I think I really don't know where I'd be if Jess hadn't been as supportive as he's been through this whole thing. So just sometimes you need somebody just to help hold your hands up, really. Just keep your arms up and just keep you going. You just almost need that. And he's brought me endless cups of coffee, which I need lots of coffee for all these books. So it's been great.
What does it feel like to finish a book and to find a house on the same day, the last day of a vacation.
Exhilarating, truly exhilarating, because I almost, you know how we have these memories of maybe when you first met your spouse, or, and you almost would love to go back and revisit that day and just remember when you first fell in love or something. And truly, this house in Tuscany was a love of another sort. And I almost would love to go back to that day when I did finish the book, and then we walked down and saw this house, because it was like, it was just like meeting your, you know, future spouse for the first time. You're just, oh my goodness, you know, you're just kind of falling in love a little bit, and what could this really happen? Could this really be? Is it possible this could be mine? And there's just a sense of wonder, and I don't know. There. I do liken it quite a lot. Somebody was asking me, actually, a friend of mine who's interested in buying a property in Tuscany, and they called up and they said, "Look, I'd just like to talk through this with you. What, you know, what is this like?" And I said, "Well, I'll tell you exactly what it's like is dating and marriage. And the day you see the property, you're just enamored, you're infatuated, you're in love, and then you go through the process and you get it, and then all of a sudden you wake up and you go, wow, I'm actually married to this thing now, and this is going to be, take some work, which it does, and then you get past that, and then you realize it very much is like marriage. You're committed. I'm committed to this village. I'm committed to this place. And yeah, there are warts, of course, just, you know, nobody's perfect, no place is perfect, but you just realize that you love it on a deeper level. So in my opinion, it's very much like marriage.
When I was about to leave for Italy a few years ago for a short trip, a friend of mine said the following: nothing is easy in Italy.
Oh, that's absolutely the truth. Yeah. Nothing is easy in Italy.
Yeah.
No, it's not.
It surprised me every time.
Yes. Yeah. No, I'm still surprised by it. I'm still thinking, are you kidding? You mean you have to have 6 documents when most people in the world are doing this, you know, electronically now? But yeah, it is. But at the same time, you put up with that because of the beautiful people, history, art, architecture, food, wine, you know, let me just list it all. And so you just go, okay, it's worth it. It's worth the craziness. And let's just laugh about it and just know it's going to be that way.
What does restoration look like at home? Talk about your relationship with Stanford, Kentucky.
Yes, that's so good. Well, we have been on a journey for about, it'll be 20 years this year is when we renovated our first guest house. And we have, my husband's bank, I'll back up there, First Southern National Bank, was founded in about 40-something years ago and is headquartered in Stanford. And that and the life insurance company. And so we have this headquarters business there. And so instead of trying to go out on a bypass and build a headquarter building with a cafeteria, we just made the decision years ago that we'd rather invest in this small town. It's Kentucky's second oldest city and very historic, of course. And the Wilderness Road goes right down our main street. So we just started buying houses to renovate for guest houses and internally at first, then we went public with it. Now it's all part of the Stanford Inn. And we have 2 restaurants, a Bluebird restaurant, Mama De Vecchio's Pizzeria, which is named after one of my Italian characters in one of my books. And we have Esther's Well House, a spa, Kentucky Soaps and Such, which has a wonderful bookstore as part of it. We do far more than soap. We make goat milk soap. But we also have a bookstore that sells lots of Kentucky books. And so that's one of our big loves too. But all of that is a passion for us because we're not only restoring and preserving these old houses, and most of them are Victorian buildings. We have one house, it's 1820s, but it's also providing a way for economic viability to happen in this small town where, you know, as most small towns are dying or have died because of all the business moving out. And so this is a way to really bring that back in. And so now what we love about restoration in Stanford is that on Saturdays, which years and years ago, Saturdays were the big day. Everybody would come out in from the county, all the farmers, they would do their trading, they would do their shopping. So it would be a huge day. Well, then for years and years since, in the last probably 40 years, it's been dead, 30 years, it's just been really dead on Saturdays because everything's gone out. Well, now, if you drive down our main street in Stanford on Saturday, it is busy again. It's bustling. The shops are open, not just our shop. Other shops are open on Main Street. The restaurants are bustling. The Coleman's Pharmacy and Deli is, and they have a little soda fountain where they still do an orangeade that they've done for I don't know how many years. And so it's not just our businesses, but other businesses as well. And so that's just, for us, is such a blessing because we live there, our employees, our staff, all live there, and family. And so we get to enjoy that as part of our environment. But then it's also been a joy to work and help create that revitalization.
What is Kentuscany pizza?
Kentuscany pizza?
Yes.
Oh, well, Kentuscany pizza. All right, that's a great one. First of all, Kentuscany is a combination of Kentucky and Tuscany. And so it is, I did not come up with that. I think somebody else years ago created that name, and I just love it. But I would say a Kentuscany pizza would have to have prosciutto on it because that's like country ham. Maybe even actually, prosciutto to me is just like country ham. It's just shaved really thin. And then we have to have a little, you know, probably the mozzarella cheese maybe, or maybe pecorino cheese from Tuscany would be better. So let's say some pecorino cheese, some prosciutto, and then what else? I don't know. What else would be good? Of course, some good homegrown tomatoes that are grown either in Kentucky or Tuscany. I think that sounds like the perfect pizza.
I've never been to Stanford. I plan to go there as soon as I can, certainly for your book launch.
Yes.
And I'm going to make sure I order a Kentuscany pizza
there
in
you
the
go.
Restaurant.
Yes. Yep.
And tell us about the three G's, grounded, guarded, and granted.
The three G's. Well, that's a trilogy, a fiction trilogy. Starts with grounded, and then guarded, and then granted. And it's about a flight attendant from New York City who loses her job, her boyfriend, her place to live, and is forced to move back home to the farm and live with her grandmother. So it's really a story about two women of different generations and how they learn to really relate to each other, because everybody in their life that kind of provided a buffer between them are now gone. And so there's always this tension between sometimes mothers and daughters, or, you know, where maybe you're too much alike, or there's just too much.
The most complicated relationships in the world are between mothers and daughters.
Absolutely. 100%. And so this grandmother raised the granddaughter because the mother died when she was 12. And so she really has been her mother. And so that complicated relationship gets unwound, but it's set against the farm and a family mystery. So there's mystery, humor, romance, just a little bit of everything. And it's Kentucky and Italy, so Tuscany, what's not to love?
Do you consider yourself a lucky person?
I consider myself, I would say fortunate, blessed, whatever the word is. Yes, 100%. I mean, to be born in the place that I've been born, to the parents I was born to, they weren't perfect, but I feel so blessed to have had the opportunities that I've had, the education I've had, so many things. The husband I have, I feel very, very blessed.
What are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on a fifth book, and it's actually going to be kind of a coffee table book, not like the big coffee table, but sort of the more bookshelf-sized coffee table. And it's about village life in Tuscany and the things that we can take home with us. So that's going to be fun. It's going to have a lot of photographs in it, too. So it's a totally different type of writing that I've done, so it'll be fun to challenge myself. But I've already got the first draft. So,
did you play Hallelujah?
Oh, did you play I did. Yeah. I did not on this one because I don't feel like it's quite there yet. I think I've got my husband's reading it. I think once he reads it and then I send it off to my friend who's going to edit it, that's when I'll play Hallelujah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Well, I wish you and your book much success and have a wonderful launch. Tell us about the launch.
Yes, so the book will be launching. It actually releases on Tuesday, March the 5th. It's right now, pre-orders are going on. And then on Friday, March the 8th, I'm going to do a book signing from 3 to 5. And of course, I'll stay a little bit after that as well at Kentucky Soaps and Such on Main Street in Stanford. And so I would love to see anybody that'd like to come out and sign books.
Thank you so much, Angela, for
coming.
Thank
you, Katarina. Thank you so much.